Welcome to New World Notes, a series that explores the gap between the America we want and the America they're trying to make us settle for, and how we the people can reestablish our commonwealth and reclaim our democracy. Edited by yours truly, Kenneth Doust. Today, war crimes and American tradition. Is there a difference between normal acts of war, supposedly good, patriotic, even heroic, and war crimes? If a guy in uniform shoots and kills me with a full metal jacket bullet, he's a soldier doing his duty for his country. If a guy in uniform shoots and kills me with a hollow point bullet, he's a war criminal. If a guy not in uniform, but maybe wearing a Yasser Arafat-like bonnet, shoots anything at me, he's a terrorist. You see the principle here. Now, someone please explain it to me, because I sure as heck can't make any sense out of it. Still, some acts in wartime are so bizarre, so warped, that we want to make a distinction between them and the normal insane barbarism of war. Like killing unarmed 12-year-olds, as U.S. forces did in Fallujah in 2004. Like killing unarmed 2-year-olds, as U.S. forces did in Haditha in late 2005. And as U.S. forces did in My Lai, South Vietnam, 40 years ago, this past March. Meet the new battle plan, same as the old battle plan. And did somebody mention torture? Today we'll just begin poking around this complex and important subject. We'll read a good essay by David Lindorf on Fallujah. Hear My Lai explained by Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Seymour Hersh. Hear some most excellent music, and put up with my own commentary. Well, if you're still listening, you might as well stay till the end of the show, so here we go. A quick musical break, then on to Fallujah.
I'ma fight for my country, though I hate the war. But I deplore even more when they take me for. Think about where you live, how you typically be. When the bombs start falling in the middle of the street, it ain't difficult to see what side to choose. With all the lies they use, can't hide the truth. White lies from these white guys in the White House. Might as well wear white sheets while they wipe out. I mean, white out all opposition. And bomb call the people into submission. He's got a Bible, he's down with Jesus Christ. He likes blacks, just ask for the leaves of rice. It's all evil lies in a weak disguise. See the signs, read in between the lines. You wanna save America, I'll bring your support. Arrest the president and bring him to court. Charge him and his puppeteers of war crimes. Assault, pay your reparations of all kinds. You think what I'm telling you to do is extreme. But if you lived in Fallujah, it'd be a beautiful dream. So I hold my tears and my hopes and fears. When you bomb our country and attack our town, don't be surprised when the whole world cheers to see another Black Hawk down.
Come with your tanks on our city streets, and you say these streets are yours. When you say you'll rebuild us with bombers and oil tankers on our shores. When you've gunned down my child in Fallujah, you needn't wonder why. I look at you through the blades of your copter and say it's a good day to die. I will fight for my country. I'll defend this land.
David Rovics, taking as usual the underdog's point of view. Now we've got this very interesting article by David Lindorf, taken from the May 24 to 25 issue of Counterpunch Online, edited and condensed for radio by yours truly. The title is Bush's War on Children in Iraq. In 1949, the Geneva Conventions were signed and adopted by the U.S. and incorporated into U.S. law. This law establishes that children under the age of 15 are classed as, quote, protected persons, unquote. Even if captured while fighting against U.S. forces, they are to be considered victims, not prisoners of war. In 2002, the Bush administration signed an updated version of that treaty, raising the protected person age to all those under 18. Treaties don't mean much to this administration, but they should mean something to the rest of us. In Bush's wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, over 2,500 children have been imprisoned, including at least 8 in Guantanamo. But capturing and imprisoning children isn't even the worst of this president's war crimes when it comes to the abuse of the young. Under Bush's leadership as commander-in-chief, the U.S. military in Iraq and Afghanistan has been considering any male child in Iraq of age 14 or older to be a potential combatant. They have been treated accordingly, shot by U.S. troops, imprisoned as enemy combatants, and subjected to torture. In the 2004 assault by U.S. Marines on the city of Fallujah, things were even worse. The New York Times reported that before the invasion, some 20,000 Marines encircled the doomed city. The White House had decided to level Fallujah because it harbored a bunch of insurgents and had angered the American public by killing and mutilating the bodies of 4 mercenaries. The 300,000 residents of the city were warned of the coming all-out attack. Women and children and old people were allowed to flee the city and pass through the cordon of troops. But the Times reported that males determined to be of combat age, in this case, 12 and up, were barred from leaving and sent back into the city to await their fate. Young boys were ripped from their screaming mothers and sent trudging back to the city to face death. In the ensuing slaughter, the U.S. dumped bombs, napalm, phosphorus, anti-personnel fragmentation weapons, and an unimaginable quantity of machine gun and small arms fire on the city. Many of these young boys died. This was a triple war crime. First of all, it was a case of collective punishment, a practice popular with the Nazis in World War II and barred by the Geneva Conventions. Second, the international laws of war also guarantees the right of surrender, so those men and boys who tried to leave, even if suspected of being enemy fighters, should have been allowed to surrender and be held as captives until their loyalties could be established. Third, as noted, the boys were protected persons who were by law to be treated as victims of war and protected from harm. Instead, they were treated as the enemy to be destroyed. For these crimes, the president should today be impeached by Congress and then tried as a war criminal. After watching this Congress cower from its responsibility to defend the Constitution, I have little hope of that happening. But I do harbor the hope that once Bush has left office, some prosecutor in another country, perhaps Spain or Canada or Germany, will use the doctrine of universal jurisdiction to indict him for war crimes. And should he leave the country for some lucrative speaking engagement, arrest him the way former dictator Augusto Pinochet was arrested by a Spanish prosecutor on a visit to the UK. For his abuse, imprisonment, and killing of children, this president should stand trial for war crimes. Ken speaking here. Not even to mention the war crime of war crimes, according to the Nuremberg Tribunal, which is the waging of an unnecessary, unprovoked war of aggression. The war crime that makes all the other war crimes possible. Here's a song about our troops' commander-in-chief.
Another unknown soldier, another lesson learned. Kick the gas can over, strike a match, get back and watch that sucker burn. Keep smiling for the camera, keep waving to the crowd. Don't let up for an instant. Stay the course and make your mama proud. You're the man. Show 'em what you're made of. You're no longer daddy's boy. You're the man that they're all afraid of. But you're only Cheney's toy. Another unknown soldier who's seen it all before, all in the name of Jesus. Behind the razor wire and shackled to the floor, just keep smiling at the camera. That twinkle in your eye. We don't need to know the answers. Long as we're safe, just hit your marks and say your lines. You're the man. Show 'em what you're made of. You're no longer daddy's boy. Take a stand. Give them what they paid for. 'Cause you're only Cheney's toy. And turn you over while a fat lady sings. One more pin on one more shoulder is all the future brings. For another unknown soldier who don't know his own name, and he won't get any older, and he can't see for the shrapnel in his brain. You're the man.
American war crimes go back a long, long way. Certainly plenty of them took place In the Philippines, at least, back in 1898, when we conquered the Philippines under the pretext of liberating them from Spain. The American war crime that first really, really captured the public's attention, as far as I can tell, took place 40 years ago at a hamlet called My Lai 4 in South Vietnam. What happened in My Lai sounds very, very much like what is happening in Iraq these days, as the speaker himself mentions. We have reporter Seymour Hersh, the person who broke the story of My Lai 20 months after it happened, giving a very good narrative and discussion of what happened there, what it all means, and suggesting ways in which it's pretty much like today. This is from an interview he gave in March 2008, at the same time the Winter Soldiers investigation was going on, in which soldiers and veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars were testifying about the horrible things that Americans had done in those wars. Here's Seymour Hersh.
The analogy with Iraq is pretty acute. Basically, it's a group of soldiers that landed. They were mostly uneducated, high school graduates and dropouts, who were told they were fighting communism, going to save America. They got to Vietnam. They spent 10, 11 weeks in the, you know, humping it in the boonies and in the villages and paddies of South Vietnam, and never saw the enemy. Maybe they lost 15 or 20% of their company through snipers, landmines, etc. But they never engaged. And over the period of 10, 11, 12 weeks, between the period they landed around New Year's Day of 68 until March 16th, they became increasingly brutal. So randomly going through a village and whacking people, sometimes an old man they saw, one soldier would just hit him with a rifle butt and nobody said anything. Because what happens inevitably is when you don't see an organized enemy and you lose people, you lose your buddies and your mates and you're angry, you take it out on the villagers, you take it out on the civilian population. And so one night they were told, the kids were told, tomorrow you're going to meet the enemy. The North Vietnamese, a regular North Vietnamese battalion is going to be there and you get a chance to get payback. They all got up at 3 or 4 in the morning, jumped on choppers, and went to kill and be killed. You have to give them their due. And they got into the village, and there's no soldiers there. The intelligence was bad, as it always is. There was no fire at all, really, just old women, men, and children heating up water for their morning rice. And they gathered them eventually into three large ditches and began to execute them. Cali became infamous, but there were five or six first and second lieutenants that were also organizing it. And as I later wrote and learned about, I spent a couple of years sort of obsessing with it, wrote a couple of books about it. One was about the cover-up. Almost during the day, every senior officer, including the major general in charge of the AmeriCal Division, this group was assigned to the AmeriCal Division, all were flying over the area at one time. And pretty much everybody knew pretty much what was going on. There you are. There was one of the kids who did a lot of shooting, was a young man named Paul Meadlow from a little small hamlet called New Goshen, Indiana. And talk about repressed memory. I learned about this almost a year and a half later. I was working in Washington as a freelance writer. I had followed the war and knew what was going on in some visceral way and knew there was something there. And I finally got to the point where I began to find kids in the unit and I was writing stories. I think I wrote five in 5 weeks as a freelancer. I had a hell of a time getting the major press to run the stories, for sure. This is always the way it is. There's always a disconnect between what the bad stuff that goes on, that everybody knows goes on, and what I guess you could call the mainstream press want to write about. I don't know why, but it's true. There always is. And in any case, one repressed memory that I didn't learn about until I was deep into the story, written two or three pieces, concerned this young man who did a lot of shooting. His name was Meadlow, as I said. He simply fired clip after clip. He was one of those, like an automat, just shot and shot into the ditch. They put people, as I said, in three large ditches. And after the shooting was over, the soldiers went and were eating their lunch, really, literally, next to the ditch, next to the bodies. And that's how disconnected you get. You obviously have to dehumanize the enemy. One mother had tucked a child, a 2 or 3 year old boy, under her stomach, and somehow he survived all the bullets. And they heard a keening noise, the soldiers told me. And this little boy climbed his way up through the ditch full of other people's blood, got to the top and began to run across the, you know, just to run away. And Lieutenant Calley turned to Meadlow, his most dependable shooter. Others had stopped at a certain point or shot high, and said, Meadlow, plug him. And Milo looked at one person and couldn't do it. And Callie then, with the great, you know, very saucy-like, grabbed his carbine. Officers had a smaller rifle called a carbine, ran behind him and shot him. Everybody remembered that because the next morning, Midler was walking on patrol with the soldiers. They moved on to a few clicks away, a mile or so away, and began the patrol again, as they always did. Just another day's work, I guess. I don't know. And he stepped on a landmine, Midler did, and blew his right leg off at the knee. And when the medevac was coming, they called in a chopper to take him away. He began to issue an oath. God has punished me, Lieutenant Callie, and God will punish you. God has punished me. And the kids, in telling me about this a year and a half later, all remembered how angry they were. Get him out of here. Get him out of here. They didn't want to hear this. And anyway, I obviously went looking for him. What a story. It took me a long time. We didn't have internet then. I remember I was in Salt Lake City calling various. I knew he was from Indiana. I knew how to spell his name. I finally found the house, town called New Goshen. I flew overnight to Chicago and then New Goshen's below Indianapolis, which is below Terre Haute, which is below. Anyway, it took me forever, and I finally found this house. And here's this old ramshackle chicken farm. Chickens all over the place. No man clearly around. And I had spoken to Milo's mother the night before, and she said, well, I don't know what it'll do. And I said, I'll be there the next day. And I show up, and she comes out to greet me. She's maybe 50, looks 70. Everything's in disrepair. And I said, I wanted to see her son. She said, he's in the house. And I said, may I go? And she said, I don't know if he'll talk to you. And then this woman, this sort of uneducated, rural woman from on the banks of the Wabash River in very south of southern Indiana, she looked at me and she said, very angry and very low, she said, I gave them a good boy, and they sent me back a murderer.
In my judgment, the Vietnam War had very, very, very few heroes. One of them did play a role in the My Lai massacre, or perhaps three of them. Returning to base from another mission, Chief Warrant Officer Hugh Thompson was piloting a helicopter accompanied by door gunner Lawrence Colburn and Crew Chief Glenn Andriotta. They happened to pass over My Lai 4 and saw what was happening below. Thompson brought the helicopter down in the line of fire from the American troops towards the innocent Vietnamese. He got out of the helicopter, was covered by the door gunner and by Andriana, who also had a gun, went up and managed to get the Americans to stop slaughtering the Vietnamese at great risk to his life. He was able to retrieve a number of people who were not yet killed, mostly children, made a couple trips taking them to the hospital, and then flew back to the base where he was roundly condemned, excoriated, and insulted for his efforts. Glenn Andriotta was killed in combat 3 weeks later. David Rovix wrote a song about Thompson.
Hugh Thompson was a pilot, just like many more, fighting for old glory on a far-off foreign shore. He was on a lethal mission, only one of many, following his orders to kill the enemy, to kill the enemy. He flew low above the village, searching for the foe. When he saw a wounded child on the path below, he thought this to be a sure sign that the enemy was near. So he radioed for backup, and more choppers did appear. More choppers did appear. Help the wounded, he cried out, and beware of an attack. And then the child died by a bullet through her back. And when he looked around for the culprits of the scene, it was a company of men in U.S. military green. U.S. military green. The dead were in the hundreds, strewn all around, in this place called My Lai, which once had been a town. There was a hut of huddled children, soldiers had them in their sights. Hugh decided at that moment to fight for what was right, to fight for what was right. Train your weapons on the GIs, and his copter crews obeyed, and stood among the children, tattered and afraid. The whole town had been murdered, but for some kids and widowed wives, and Hugh Thompson made sure that those remaining would survive. That those remaining would survive. It was a 15-minute standoff in a knee-deep sea of red, amidst the moaning of the dying and the silence of the dead. Hugh Thompson was a soldier, and he served his country well. On the day he saved the lives of a dozen kids in hell. Of a dozen kids in hell.
Thanks for listening. New World Notes is produced in the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of the University of Hartford. Our 5.5 minutes of Seymour Hersh are taken from a long interview made available by democracynow.org, and many thanks. The opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent the views of anyone even remotely connected with this station. Though Leo the janitor wants to know why everyone's heard of Lieutenant Kelly, but nobody's heard of Hugh Thompson. Could it be that the Pentagon doesn't want soldiers to realize that they don't have to sell their souls to the devil? Oh, Leo, there you go with your conspiracy theories again. Your comments and suggestions are most welcome. Why not send me an email at kdowst, that's K-D-O-W-S-T, at hotmail.com. Until next time, here's wishing you a good week. Illa get to my non-carborundum, and keep the faith.